When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And critically, I also put Masked Agent onto Yasunori.
That's nice.
Well, yeah, nice isn't perhaps the right word. But yeah.
In this episode, we have Paul Butler, Jamie Varney, and James Doxey, the three top finishers at the English GT. And you can definitely tell that these guys have a lot of fun playing against each other, and they've been doing it for a while because the four of us have a lot of fun. You learn about a nasty turn one play from Jamie that he brought into Paul Shenlong. Peter reveals which resident Brexionist master Shenlong fears the most. We have a great discussion on round times at events, some pros and cons of soloing a master in an event, and some really interesting thoughts on whether you should be seeding points early or late with plant explosives. Make sure you stay to the end when we talk about the current state of the metas and where we think all the factions fall competitively against each other. And there might be an Easter egg at the very end of the episode. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're talking with the three people that filled the podium in the 2019 English GT. Now there was 26 players over 2 days and 6 rounds, and these three gentlemen finished first, second, and third. Now the winner of the event was Jamie Varney, second place James Doxey, and then third place Paul Butler. Now, you know the winner of the event, Jamie, from his great deep dives into Albus and Karai, and he's also one of the people that was on our first expert roundtable episode, one of my all-time favorite episodes. And I'm going to have a link to all of those in the show notes. If you have missed those episodes, you want to check them out. So, Jamie, welcome back to the Third Floor.
Hi, Craig. Thanks for having me.
So, what have you been doing to get ready for Nationals?
Not a huge amount, actually. Painting Bayou models at the moment is what I'm doing with my free time.
No, but you're going to play Rezzers, right, in Nationals?
Yes, I expect so, yeah.
Okay.
Not giving anything away there.
I will tell you, though, the fact that Jamie has found an interest in Bayou is a good indication that they are broken and that there's a problem, because that's about the only thing that would attract Jamie to want to play them. But our second place and other guest is James Doxey. Now, James took second, like I mentioned, and you probably know him both from the roundtable that I mentioned with Jamie, but also his incredible deep dive into Kara. So, James, welcome back to the Third Floor.
Thank you for having me.
I assume you're not switching factions for Nationals. So what have you been up to?
Trying to broaden out my master selection a little bit to make sure I've got two masters I want to bring to all the strategies. So that's been my focus in the sort of 4 or 5 weeks we've got between now and Nationals.
So what are some, is it top, because this is not going to come out till after Nationals. It might come out. So you want to be careful, but is there a master that you have been focusing on that you're trying to get kind of up to speed with?
I like the
would
idea.
Would you rather keep that secret?
I like the idea that my primary opposition isn't on the phone call with us right now. So this coming out later probably won't help. Help overlay.
That's true. We'll say no comment, James. We'll say no comment. Okay. And then the third place finisher, Paul Butler. Now, Paul's never been on the show. He did send in a question for the Shenlong episode, so you've heard his voice on the show. But Paul is a consistent
winner over there in the UK, and his 10 Thunders play is something that's dangerous. So, Paul, welcome to the third floor.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
So if you didn't know, that was I think it was Jamie that was chuckling in the background when I talked about Paul being a good player. But Paul, you know, we've heard this from both James and Jamie, but can you kind of tell us how you found Malifaux and what got you into it?
How did I find Malifaux? As luck would have it, depending on your point of view, I started sort of getting back into gaming after a 20-year break. And I think I just randomly found Malifaux. Oh, no, I was talking to somebody at a board game place about Malifaux. And he said, well, actually, the place to go is Harrogate. It's got one of the most active clubs and a club with a lot of good players. And I was doing some training over there on a Thursday, which was when they met, and that's how you got stuck with me.
So that means you've been playing Malifaux for how long now?
Since what edition? Second edition, just as Book 2 came out. So what about, is it 4 years now?
Yeah, I would say about three, four, or five years. So that's great. So, guys, what we're going to try to do is I'm trying to pick your brains so that we can kind of learn how things went round by round, some of the key takeaways from each of them. We're going to kind of summarize day one and then really focus on the last three rounds in day two. But I want to learn kind of what led them to finish so strong in such a competitive field. And was there anything that they discovered about the game over the 2 days? Kind of their perspective, either on their particular masters, their play, or maybe the meta in general. And then we're going to learn, you know, what did they bring? So let's start off with you, James. Can you kind of talk us through some of the key takeaways and where you finished after day one?
Yeah, certainly. So probably my key points for day one, I'd started to be able to, I kind of felt like I was getting into my stride a bit with third edition at this event. So I was able to start doing things like actually tick against the master I was playing. So not just kind of focus on what do I need to do in a given objective set, but actually also start to really tick against opposing masters. So I was able to bring Howard Langston into game two, playing against Zip. And find that actually, despite the fact I was playing Sandeep, paying the hiring tax, bringing that in, and being able to tech in that way. So I'm feeling like I'm kind of getting beyond that initial, figuring out what I'm doing and what the objectives are, and actually then figuring out how to play into my opponent. And that's something sort of crew selection choices I think were quite on point this weekend for me. So that would probably be my takeaway.
It takes a certain amount of familiarity, doesn't it, James? I mean, you have to get real comfortable to be able to kind of flex out of your normal list or what you normally would bring.
Yeah, that and probably my other takeaway was just how infested with Rezzers London seems to be. I think was it going into round three of day one? We were at I think there were seven Rezzers across the sort of the top seven tables. Overall.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, by the end of that round, though, fortunately, I'd got up into third place and ended the day in third.
Nice. Do you think that's meaningful in your mind? Does it just mean a bunch of people in London brought Rezzers, or do you think that it's starting to reveal something about the faction and where it fits in overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably a bit of both, right? I think that's certainly something you can get either way. I think, you know, geography has something to do with it. I think as well, though, I mean, I'm always interested in the the psychology of the factions, and sort of, I often think that sometimes you find that Rezzer players seem to be a bit down on their kit, and actually, I think you find as you look back through the history of Malifaux, Rezzers tend to wind up as the best faction, simultaneously while their player base seem to be the most vocal about how terrible their faction is.
So you, as an Arcanist player, you're telling me it's Rezzers that are whiny?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm telling you.
Okay. So James, do you think there was one particular game of the three there that you think was the difference maker?
There were a couple of points in any of them I could point to. Certainly playing against in round three, I played against Seamus, who's not someone I've faced before. And that was quite an interesting game. There was a red Joker into a Seamus whispered into a red Joker into Kerris in turn one. So Kerris got slammed for sort of 8 damage after reduction. Something in that region. And that led to quite a brutal sort of back and forth game, neither master surviving. And I just got out ahead on that. But that was sort of was an interesting test case in what to do when things go wrong early, and then sort of how you fight back. So I was quite quite pleased sort of coming out of there, managing to sort of scrabble into that third win to end the day on 3 wins. And I was slightly worried because Paul was also on 3 wins, and we may wind up playing each other in the morning. And Paul and I are teammates, so we were sharing an Airbnb. And I genuinely went through my head, oh, my God, does my room door lock? Because if we were playing each other the next morning, I was envisioned waking up being smothered in my sleep with a pillow.
Day anyway. 2 forfeit from James Doxy.
Yeah, that's it. Bed in a ditch somewhere in London.
Yeah.
A reasonable fear.
I can tell you that, Seamus with Whisper on him can be pretty scary because if he has the cards, he can change things real quick. And a red Joker from Seamus, to your point, James, even with reduction and everything, still results in anywhere from 7 to 9 points of damage, which can change the game plan a little bit. So, Jamie, how about you? Can you kind of give us an idea of how day one went for you? What key takeaways maybe that you had? And if there was, anything that you think may have possibly affected how you went into day two?
Yeah, day one went well. It was actually swung massively in round two when the game finished at like a crucial point where it was a 3-point swing in the game, but it actually changed the matchups massively. So yeah. I would have had to play Matt Lewin in round three, but actually the 3 points that I'd missed out on in round two had meant that I didn't have to play Matt, and Matt went on to play someone else. And so it swung the day massively, which actually playing Matt day one would have been a really, really tough match. So it was fortunate. I didn't realize until afterwards. I walked away from the game a little bit like, oh no, I've lost 3 points there. And then when we worked out actually that it had avoided me playing Matt, who I was also traveling with, similar to James and Paul. I was quite glad of the situation. But
Jamie, I hear people, obviously, whether you win or lose the game early rounds matters as far as, who you match up with later, and your diff matters and who you match up with later. And I've heard people talk about, trying not to have too big of a win round one and two so that you, don't get yourself pushed up into the kind of the higher tier of competition. Have you ever found yourself even thinking about that when you're playing a game?
I end up playing most of the top people anyway, whenever I go, regardless of how well I'm doing. I can lose a game and then still just get the worst matchup usually. So I go for the points as much as I can get them, because as this tournament showed, the VP diff can make or break your event.
Yeah, so any VPs you cheat yourself out of round one, you can end up not getting the first or second place because of it.
You can really screw yourself, and it's not only that, is you've got to be really, really sure what matchup you're giving yourself if you're even considering it, because there's no telling that actually that other top player on the table down the row from you isn't going to randomly get a draw and then you end up playing against them. It's just, you've just got to go and get as many points you can, try and win every game as best you can.
And so much is out of your control. So exactly. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you're a Rezzer player and so am I. So, can you tell me what 3 masters you played, or it may not have been 3 different ones, but what masters did you bring to 1, 2, and 3?
So round one was Plant Explosives, which I took Molly to. Round two was Corrupted Idols, which I took Von Stuck, and round three was Turf War, which I also took Von Stuck for.
Very nice. So Von Stuck twice, and then Molly. Two strong masters. I like it. So Paul, day one, 3 rounds. How did you finish after 3 rounds? And what were the key takeaways?
So I had a good day one.
I got a new player round one, so it was kind of fairly relaxed start. And then randomly, I got a partner round two, which was interesting. And is it in guild? So I thought I was in for another sort of relaxed game until what was it? The lone marshal sort of zoomed up and did run and gun and shot Shenlong for about 6 points of damage when he was already on sort of three while he did his thing. So. Yikes. You know, I'm sort of down on, so I think I was down to four wounds he got me to. And at that point, Lady J had been brought up the table but hadn't activated. And yikes. I'm like, oh no. So, yeah, that was, you know, kind of just thinking, yeah, guild, fine. I don't have a problem with guild. Lady J, equally, I know she's better, but, you know, again, not. I didn't perceive it as a threat, and I felt very differently, sort of. And this is all it was wedge deployment, so it was all in turn one. I'm thinking, oh my word.
Sure.
And managed to recover it. Shenlong just spent turn one healing himself, and sort of then, you know, things sort of started to go the way I wanted them to. But yeah, that was proper scary. I thought, you know.
Yeah, and Paul, I know that you had 10 Thunders for the event. Was it truly you bringing 10 Thunders, or was it just six rounds of Shenlong?
Shenlong's the only thing I'm playing at the minute. Yeah. I've, you know, there were issues around models that weren't available. Which is
why would you play anything else though, right?
Well, you know, I mean, to be honest, no. I mean, McCabe has got game, and yeah. Yang Lo is also. I've come up against you know, a well played Yang Lo is very, very strong. So, to be honest, it's just everything's available. For Shenlong, which I couldn't say the same for McCabe. And to be honest, I was moving into Neverborn, and I ended up going back into 10 Thunders because I wasn't able to play Nakima because the totem wasn't available, and I got a bit irritated about it, as I do. So anyway, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, so Shenlong is just, and to be honest, playing one master just gives you an edge because you get into that relatively smooth mechanic, and you're less likely to sort of miss things that you can take advantage of. So, you know, yeah. And Shenlong's quite good.
Yeah, but I do think that suits your play style because it's something you've always done is you've kind of aimed to focus on a master, whereas personally I prefer, you know, I like to spread out and focus on a faction. I think some of that is in the different player psychology. And I know Jamie sort of likes to sort of bounce around factions but sort of focus on rezzers after mm-hmm. the event. I think that's fair to say. So I think sometimes it's about what suits individuals and their play style.
Also good. It's good for you too, Paul, because Shenlong is so flexible, right? So you really aren't hurting yourself because Shenlong is very good, but really he's playable in any pool.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always liked the toolbox in M2E. I played primarily McCabe for the same reasons, that high mobility and that ability to sort of change up the style depending on what you end up facing on the table and what your opponent is doing. You know, that's just, yeah, it's what I enjoy.
Okay, that's great. So, James, I know you have it handy. Can you let us know kind of where each of you were at the end of day one?
Certainly. So at the end of day one, Jamie was in first, three wins and up plus 10 difference. Paul was in
nice.
Second, again, three wins and up plus 7 difference. And I was in third, again, three wins and up 4 difference. And we were the only 3-on-3 wins at that point.
Interesting. So I guess I don't even think I realized that the three of you guys were essentially, even though there was some swapping around by the end of the next three rounds, you guys all, you know, went into day two so strong. So that's great. That's great. Well, guys, let's take a quick break. And we get back from the break, I want to kind of break this up and go round by round for the last three rounds. So we're going to get a little bit more detailed in how day two went. So we'll be right back.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Now, something I've always thought was kind of interesting is, you know, in the U.S., we often see just over a two-day or it tends to be a five-round tournament. And I think a lot of that is because of the amount of distances traveled that getting three rounds in on a Sunday, which is usually when day two is a little tough. But I've noticed that a lot of the 2 day events over in the UK has six rounds. So you really, you know, you get two full sets. And obviously the more rounds you play, the more things will shake out and the amount of maybe luck in your matchups early tend to fall away during that process. Jamie, do you have any thoughts as far as, you know, playing six rounds versus five?
Yeah, so a part of that is down to our ranking system, where it awards you more points for more rounds. So you can get a maximum of, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think it's 120. Paul will know for sure off the top of his head. It's 120.
I've got the table open as we speak.
Yeah, so I think it's 120 for a five-round 130 for a six round, 140 for a seven round, which is nationals. And it's also the volume of players in some cases, just to make sure you get that sort of true winner. But I think those points are right, aren't they, Paul? Or is that?
So, it depends on, obviously, if you got 28 players, and six rounds, it does make a heck of a difference in terms of, you know, you're only losing, you know, barely sort of five ranking points per tier, starting off at 130. So, you know, 130, 125, 121, etc. So it does make it, it adds value, and particularly going down into sort of even at 10th, you're getting 93 ranking points, which, you know, is, well, it's almost the same as winning a single day that's got 28 people at, you know. So, I think that's what drives it.
I mean, I have to say, it's not something that was, it was sort of, it's not something I'm particularly thrilled about, actually, is driving the rounds that way. I'd rather move back to a one day, 2 day distinction. But the, you know, it certainly encourages more rounds, which is more Malifaux. And at the end of the day, I suppose to my general maxim when it comes to any kind of competitive policy, it's like if it encourages more people to play more Malifaux, then it's probably a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, more is better. And when do you guys usually finish up on a Sunday when you have a six rounder?
Too late.
Yeah. It depends how drunk the TO got the night before. Which I'll say is not a criticism of Tom, who ran the English GT, who is a consummate professional throughout and looks a lot like Bradley Cooper. But there's a compliment for you. But occasionally you do get you do have a slower start on Sunday than you would like where people have had a hectic night before.
And often it's six-ish.
Let's talk about round six-ish.
Yeah.
So let's talk about round four. So the deployment was flank deployment, and the strategy was reckoning. The pool was detonate the charges, take prisoner, power ritual, outflank, and vendetta. So a pretty killy strategy with only one scheme focus, with the only one So we have Achilles strategy, and we have one scheme that focuses on removing models. Two of the schemes force you to keep the models alive, and two push you to the corners to score. So, James, I know that you had an Arcanist on Arcanist battle against Matt, who's a friend of the show. You won 4-2. Can you walk us through what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So, interestingly, when you know who you're playing the next day, there is always a bit of analysis sort of the night before. So I'd spent a bit of time thinking about, and I knew Matt had a number of options and probably was going to land playing either Hoffman or Karis. And I'd spent a little bit of time figuring out how on earth a Karis mirror works, because there's some really odd interactions in that matchup. So I'd spent a little bit of time figuring that out, and then kind of what I wanted to do if it was Hoffman. It was Hoffman, and I played in the final round of the Scottish GT that Matt won. I played against Matt's Hoffman. So I'd kind of seen it before. And I know he's been on the cast talking about Hoffman recently, which is a really nice episode and well worth a listen. So kind of going into that, I kind of knew what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to play Karis. I wanted the mobility and the ability to stand off. I brought a December Acolyte to give me some armor ignoring, which helped. And I knew I wanted to play Outflank and Power Ritual so that we could sort of play the edges. And that caused the game to develop on three fronts. Broadly, there was a fight in the middle and a fight at either end, offset slightly. And I think what the game turned probably on an activation decision in turn two for Matt. So we got a position where Matt had Howard and Soulstone Miner in one corner looking to do Power Ritual outflank, and I had a Spider Swarm there and a Soulstone Miner ready to surface. And then in the center ground, Joss was pretty badly injured fighting Karis and Iggy. Matt got the initiative and chose to activate to heal Joss to keep him alive and keep him in the fight, which gave me the option to activate the swarm. I think he'd have been better off activating Howard and deleting my swarm. Howard already had his grit turned on because he'd taken some damage already. Fortunately, my swarm was still over half wounds, so still had its positive to damage flips built in.
It's so brutal.
So the swarm was able to just jump into Howard, knocks him down to defense three, goes in for the initial hit, manages to kill Howard, and then has the AP left to also kill the Soulstone Miner, which I'll grant you was performing a bit above average, for a swarm. And I should say the swarm had a diesel engine, so it wasn't a vanilla swarm. It was a 10-point model on an enemy, but able to delete that corner, which gave me my reckoning point for the turn, and effectively denied, made out flank and power ritual very, very difficult for Matt at that point. And I think that turned the game.
Now, do you remember, James, how many points of reckoning did you score? How much of your 4 points were on the strat?
I got 2-1 upon reckoning itself, and then a point each. On the other two to make it a 4-2. Matt got 1 point of power ritual and 1 point of reckoning.
Yeah, it's really hard to get that third point in reckoning in general, but to try to get that third point against a Hoffman crew with somebody as quality a player as Matt is, that is a tough third strategy point.
Yeah.
So for matchups, we have Jamie and Paul playing each other. So I'm going to allow Paul to talk us through what happened. I know, Paul, it was a tight game. I think you lost just by a point. So what was the matchup? What was your thinking going into it? And how did it end up playing out in your mind?
I was playing Shenlong, which was no surprise to Jamie. Jamie decided to take Von Stuck, which I wouldn't say I was expecting, but, I was kind of comfortable with, or at least I was before we played the game. And, it was one of those things. I'd faced Jamie very early on with Von Stuck, so I understood the mechanism for sort of loading up the Valedictorian and sort of shooting it into the crew to take something out high value, bring something in, and then have the students or whatever they are come in with the by your side. So I was sort of ready for what was going to come, or at least I thought I was. And so I'd set my crew up. The crew, obviously, it's a lot of support around Shenlong with Yasunori and or something else as a sort of secondary beta, and then a lot of low value chaff, which isn't necessarily ideal for Reckoning, but I figured against Von Stuck, I was going to create a situation where it was going to be challenging to get that kind of in and get something with value. So I kind of purposely, I had a number of Wandering River that are only 5 points, so they weren't going to get you much out. And then I think it was sort of the next level. I had a Charm Warder, but I put the Charm Warder at the back, out of range of the Alpha Strike, so that effectively there was only Chaff, Yasunori, that isn't going to be something he can take down. Well, it was unlikely he could take down Yasunori in one hit, as good as the Valedictorian is, and then Shenlong.
Yeah.
So I set up like that and kind of hoped that the Valedictorian would be thrown in. But Jamie sort of managed to wrong foot me. He did the
How so?
Well, I knew what was.
Does it make more sense if I tell you what the Valedictorian did, and then Paul talks about what he did afterwards?
How I felt about it afterwards. Yeah, go on.
Let's hear it, Jamie.
So I hadn't played against Shenlong, so I wasn't. I obviously have heard a lot about him. There's a lot of chatter about him, and I hadn't, whilst not be really playing against him, I sort of understood how the setup worked for him. Mm-hmm. And I made a decision that activation two, I think, of turn one, I was just going to go for it and bank on Valedictorian with one action being able to kill two, potentially three models. So I went straight in for the, I can't remember what they're called, the Shenlong's totems.
Yes, aspiring students, right?
Yeah, so Vali was fast, so she walked forward twice, charged into one of those. I think I stoned for a shove aside to then move into a Wandering River Monk, and then flurried onto the other aspiring. I ended up killing one of the aspiring students and the Wandering River Monk between Valedictorian's three attacks, which I was pretty happy with. And then that gave me that battery for then the undergraduates to jump in and kill the other Wandering River Monk. And I think I killed the Healing Monk as well with another undergraduate. I think I killed four models turn one, which in Reckoning isn't great, but what I wanted to do was basically pin Paul's crew for as long as I could, knowing that Shenlong could more or less kill anything he wanted to in my crew, but pin it there for long enough to score some points and get up in the game.
So two things there real quick, Jamie. One, for those of you that aren't familiar with Von Stuck and with Transmortis, so, you know, you have a way to give fast. He takes Valedictorian and then he takes her in there. She's got shove aside, which gives you another extra attack. And because she's a hench, she can stone for it. She has flurry, but the big key there is the by your side. So if you've got undergraduates, you can now use her as the node to bring in those undergraduates, which honestly, they hit pretty good for their weight. And the ability to essentially get, you know, two or three models right in the middle of their stuff is pretty brutal. The one other question I have for you, though, Jamie, is at that point, are you concerned about a counterattack from Shenlong or from Yasunori? Or are you just saying, hey, I'm going to send the Val in there. She's going to do as much as she can. And I'm going to pop some students in there and just see how it plays out.
So what I thought would happen is that I would lose Valedictorian and maybe an undergraduate, which is what happened. The whole idea behind it was how far it would set Paul back in the game.
Right.
And it more or less did what it needed to, because actually in the grand scheme of things, reflecting on the game, actually it put me in a really vulnerable position. But it enabled me to play a game I was comfortable with, because I wasn't really sure what Shenlong did, mm-hmm. In terms of how he would actually play on the table past the theory of it. Whereas now, if I went into that game again, I probably wouldn't play it that way. But it was what enabled me to do was set the terms of the game to Paul and then be able to go out. And because I knew I'd taken Power Ritual outflank, pinning Paul in his deployment zone for a turn, and then the rest of my crew spreading out to the flanks, I was comfortable with.
So, Paul, that sounds like that was a ton of fun for you.
At the time, it was one of those, I mean, it was a surprise. But to be honest, you know, at the end of turn one, I was very comfortable with where I was. Because I decided to kill the Valedictorian because, you know, it's a threat. I'd killed in, you'd summoned in, I think, a Necropunk off killing the Wandering River. So that died. So there'd been nothing summoned in effectively. And I think I had two students in amongst my crew. But that crew included a full strength Shenlong, a full strength Yasunori, Sensei Yu, which, you know, he's got game and he's drawing cards. So whilst the damage he does is incidental, the fact he draws, assuming he hits, he draws four cards, giving you the resources you need to sort of really maximize Shenlong and Yasunori. So, you know, to be honest, I wasn't worried at the beginning of turn two. I'd been set back because I'd lost my both Wandering River Monks, which are, you know, the speed that I get off in Shenlong. But, you know, in terms of what resources were left on the table, at that point I was facing Von Stuck and Lovelace and a few and some other chaff. And I'd lost my scheme runners, but I still had the killy element of my crew and we were playing Reckoning.
So, how did you know the next couple turns play out for you then, Paul? So, you know, you took some damage, but it sounds like you made Jamie pay for that. What do you think was the difference maker as far as the results, like the way the rest of the game played out?
I decided I took Power Ritual as well. I'm trying to remember. I think I took Jamie, maybe you can remember better. Did I take a Vendetta?
I'm not actually sure. I don't have. I've only got a score for Power Ritual for you. I don't have.
Yeah. Well, I know I took Power Ritual.
I think you might have taken out flank, didn't you? Because that's where the Wandering River Monk was trying to go.
Yeah, could have been. Yeah. Although I never attempted. So assuming I'd taken. It would have made most sense to thinking about it, Power Ritual outflank. So at that point, I couldn't score outflank in the sense of I hadn't got anything fast enough. I'd already gone heavy towards the right of the table. So getting a model over on the left, and it's possible with Shenlong, but very difficult without his aspiring students. So what I decided to do was just go heavy into one side and, you know, make sure I got my my Power Ritual, and I was expecting outflank. So it was a case of, you know, I had the ability to dominate one flank, which I didn't do quite fast enough. Jamie got Power Ritual, I think, and outflank in turn two, and I didn't have enough to stop that happening, or I couldn't get over into that corner to stop it happening quickly enough.
So, Paul, do you have any advice for those out there that are when their opponent declares Von Stuck? Did you have any takeaways about, you know, how to handle, cause his transporters are strong. So did you learn anything in the process or any tips you can give for people to play against it?
I mean, to be honest, to some extent, it's a one trick pony. It's very strong, but it's like, I throw the Valedictorian at you and then, you know, bring my other sort of killy secondary models in off the back of that. And and it's, and of course it's that, you know, that ability to summon something usually a bit meatier off the valedictorian kill. So there's that flip of, you know, you kill an 8-point model and bring in an 8-point model. That's such a huge shift in resource.
Yeah.
And the fact you can then back it up with, you know, they're not isolated because you can bring in the students on the back, the undergraduates, sorry. To be honest, the way I set up was right. That would have worked eventually. It was a gamble, and it's a gamble that sort of only just paid off.
Yep.
By the end of the game, it was, the game was going in a different direction. We just didn't get there.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie, you know, you mentioned that, you know, in hindsight, you may have wanted to do things a little bit different. According to a Weird Place post, Shenlong's unbeatable, but apparently he's not. What was kind of your key takeaways?
So I think it's quite important to clarify here, and Paul's being quite a gentleman to not say it, but actually we only got three turns in, and from where we were in the game, I think Paul probably would have won if we'd got five turns in. So the going in and pinning Paul in his deployment zone was great and actually did what I needed to, because it allowed me to score points early. But it left me vulnerable towards the end of the game, because actually, although I'd killed a lot of Paul's models for scheming, he just had powerhouses still on the board, whereas I'd lost a lot of my killing potential. But Shenlong, like, now I know what he does. He is scary. He is really, really strong. I wouldn't play it that way again. I would do something similar, because actually the valedictorian going in with the support is great. And the problem with Shenlong is that there's nowhere I can go. I can't move forward and set up and be ready and sort of set myself up for a turn two assault, because Shenlong will get there. He's just got the most ridiculous reach.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
So I'm not sure that going in all guns blazing was a bad idea. I just think, and it was just about picking that fight. And I was never going to kill Shenlong or Yasunori or Sensei Yu with the amount of stones Paul had. So it made sense for me to go for the chaff. And then just try and run my schemes. I think the only thing I would have done differently was probably put the upgrade onto Anna or the Student of Viscera, so that they could then summon something bigger later in the game rather than waste it on a Necropunk turn one.
Yeah, I would say, having played a second game against Von Stuck, he's the best choice versus Shenlong, I would think. His sort of 6-inch aura where you shut down the upgrades it almost completely neutralizes Shenlong. I to be honest, I think if you could play within that aura, that scared. I'm not exactly sure how I would cope with that in another game.
It's definitely good against Shenlong. It's just in that scheme pool, there's no way we're playing in a bubble in the centre. Mm-hmm. Like, there was the best schemes in there by far for the strat and the deployment are Power Ritual and Outflank. I think it was always going to go that way, and I couldn't really rely on it. I wanted to play Jack because it's a Jackdaw game, but the lack of demise abilities from Charm Orders scared me off of Jack.
Oh, I can imagine so. And, you know, you had a bit of an advantage there too, Jamie, because you knew what master was going to get declared, which is, you know, a little bit of a downside to Paul's approach. I think there's a ton of upside to what Paul does, you know, soloing a master, because you become very good at it, and it allows you to, I think, play the game more than just play your crew. You knowing that you're going to be facing the monk crew, saved you from potentially, making a bad pick with Daw. James, the game with you and Matt, how many rounds did you guys get through?
I don't recall, and I didn't make notes. I've got on that. That's probably the only thing I didn't write down.
Well, do you remember if you guys finished it? Did you get to round five?
We certainly didn't get round of five. I think we might have got four. Time was fairly tight on the day.
So here's a question, and I'll start with James, but I'm anxious to hear Paul and Jamie's thoughts. And obviously we don't know exactly, but like ballpark guys, how far away are we from seeing more complete games in tournaments under time, do you think, James?
I think we're probably one of those things where people are playing summoners and where we've got quite complex games, I think we are always going to struggle for time. I'm coming round to the idea that actually probably 2 hours 15 is a lot better than 2 hours. I think if we were playing 2 hours 15, you'd see a lot more, 2 hours 20, you'd see a lot more games finishing, because those last two turns tend to be fairly rapid. And sort of certainly relative, most of the game occurs in turn two and turn three, I think. And certainly the bulk of the time of the game. So I think another 15 minutes in round times would probably be what it needs to sort of start to see it regularly get into four and five. And, you know, I think that'd probably be healthier, but I appreciate obviously there are constraints on the, there are constraints on the time of the day.
Yeah. How about you, Paul? Do you think we're close to people getting familiar enough with their crews and the game to start seeing some more game fives, or are we going to be a year and a half from now and still only seeing people finish, you know, turn three, turn four?
My games, yes. No, I mean, obviously, I've got a really horrible reputation for being slow, and, you know, I can be. And it doesn't help that I'm playing pretty complex crews that tend to have a high model count, and not just high model count, a lot of stuff going on. A lot of my crews do not simply go walk focus or walk charge or anything nonsense like that. There's lots of interlocking parts. So I think James is correct. I think the game is in a great place, but I think you need more time to get a decent number of rounds in on a reliable basis, unless you're smashing your opponent, which in good play doesn't happen that much. The game is complex. You know, that's what makes it fun. There's lots of choices to make. And, you know, making the right choice sometimes takes a little time. So yep. I think 2:15 is a more realistic standard time play. And we do that and we speed up a bit. And, yeah, you know, round three and round four, they will be my friends.
I was just going to come in quickly on that, and something I probably should have said as well is I think what's helping at the moment is most events are providing objectives in advance, which at least allows people to consider what it is that they're going to bring, which does save, you know, probably does save 5 minutes crunch at the start of games. Mm-hmm. And also allows a lot more banter and sort of fun up front as people, you know, and a lot more practice games. It sort of, I think it generally is quite a positive thing. I don't think our Nationals is doing that this year, so I'm going to be quite interested to see what that does to impact the, you know, the amount of time available as well, and sort of, you know, number of rounds people are getting in. Because again, not having that in advance is probably something where we're going to see, you know, potentially having a knock-on effect, particularly where games are quite close and players are quite skill matched.
Yeah, so that's brutal. I didn't realize that. So you're not going to get the pools ahead of time for Nationals?
That's certainly my understanding.
Wow. Jamie, do you agree? Do you think we need to start looking at maybe extending the round times for M3E, or do you think it's just the newness hasn't worn off yet?
I'd like to see it extended. I think that there should always be enough time to get as many turns in as you can, and it is hard sometimes, especially like in mine and Paul's game where so much happened turn one. And you're asking a lot of questions, and actually every decision you make is important in those, especially on the top tables in the later rounds. You do need to be sure of what you're doing, so you're asking clarifying questions and you're making sure of things, because you're not as familiar with, like, from in my case, I didn't know what Shenlong, I didn't know all of Shenlong's rules. Paul certainly had only played Albus once, so probably wouldn't be super familiar with him, so you do end up with a lot of questions, a lot of time for stuff like that. But actually you need to be able to do that in the game. So it's I would like to see more time. A part of it will wear off as everyone learns what things do, and you learn not only what your own models do but what your opponent's models do and how those rules work, and then that will speed the game up slightly. But I still think it is a complex game, and it's not going to hurt to have 2:15 as your standard round time. I wouldn't even say that it would be out of the question to ask for 2:15 plus 10 minutes to choose your crew. I think you could fit that in a day, and I think a lot of events give you more time for, say, lunch breaks than you need, and actually you could shave some time there to add on to the round times to make sure everyone gets a quality game.
Well, and there's all the shuffling around, right? Getting to the table, finding out your matchups, the packing and unpacking. Anybody who's ever seen me play, I think I've got, 7 pounds worth of kit that I bring to the table because I love gadgets and stuff like that. I love 2.5 hour rounds. If you can finish before that, that gives you some more time to mentally unpack. But the big restriction is literally time, being able to start early enough and, go long enough. I'm with you guys on that. Well, let's take a quick break, and let's, when we get back from the break, let's talk about round 5. Howdy friends, Craig here. With 3rd edition Malifaux released, it's time for you to get a new mat with new deployment zones. We've tried every mat in the business, and nobody has better quality and selection than Mats by Mars. They're waterproof and they roll and unroll easily, and they're even wet erase Marco compatible. They offer over 35 designs and let you add M3EO overlays for making deployment and positioning a breeze. Check them out at matsbymars.com. They are offering a sweet discount for our listeners. After you found the perfect mat, use the promo code 3rdfloor to get 10% off your entire order. If you really want to support us, in the notes of your order, request that our logo be put in the corner of your mat. It's the only way to make the best mat in the business even cooler. Again, that's Mat by Mars. Use the promo code 3rdfloor to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. So how much are 3 or 4 of these episodes worth to you a month? Third Floor Wars has a Patreon, and if you think they're worth $1, $5, $20 a month, swing by and become a patron. We have polls that decide the next episode of the pod, along with early releases of articles and podcasts. Everything we release goes out to everyone, but sometimes our patrons get a head start. The link is in the show notes, or just search for Third Floor Wars on patreon.com. Thanks for the support. Okay, so now second to last round, the pairings are getting intense. The one thing about having the three of these guys to be finishing in the day one podium, that there's going to be clashes with each other come day two. And a lot of times the way it shakes out is you end up obviously not having the same top three at the end of day two. So it's real interesting to see how this played out. So let's talk about round 5. It was standard deployment with Turf War. Breakthrough, harness the ley line, hold up their forces, power ritual, and assassinate. So Turf War in standard deployment tends to be a pretty tight game. You have one scheme that looks for you to knock out the leader, so very killy. The three of them have you dropping markers to score, so they're kind of competing with each other as far as action efficiency. And then you've got one that's having you hold up the models and keep the opponent's models alive in order to score. So, Paul, you ended up playing Carl Lee's Resurrectionist, and Carl's a friend of the show, and it ended up being a tie. Can you kind of walk us through that game?
Yeah. So, Carl was playing Kirai. It was one of those games where lots of stuff happened and very little got achieved.
Okay.
Effectively what happened, we both moved forward doing our thing. He summoned in something and pushed his sort of killer models forward. And obviously the totem is sort of there, sort of causing a problem insofar as, as I would normally deal with something like that, killing it doesn't work because it just comes back. It was one of those we squared off in the middle of the board and just failed, I think would be the only way to describe it. I sort of sent Shen along in along with Yasunori. I had the support of the Charm Warders because obviously there was summoning models, so there was that threat of getting the exercise trigger and making something die just instantly without anything. And I think I did achieve that once. But it was a really strange game insofar as Shenlong and Yasunori just couldn't kill anything, which, you know, it's just not how it's supposed to work. I couldn't explain it. It wasn't that I had particularly bad luck and Carl had good luck. It was just, for both of us, the luck just seemed to come at the wrong time. So whenever there was that sort of critical need to push through an attack or get a hit a moderate, it just never seemed to happen. That was what I found. But then I think Carl was sort of experienced the same thing on his side. I mean, there was a sort of crazy situation where I'd sent in the charm warder to do, you know, an attack. And just decided to do its free action that does the pulse, causing people to sort of flip cards and take damage if, you know, you choose the right suit. Well, of course, not a single suit came up, but poor old Carl. But poor old Carl had to discard, I think, 3 severes and a red joker.
Oh, boy.
And he was not happy, which, you know, and it was that kind of dumb luck, but, you know, in some sort of weird negative world where, and we just ended up not getting anything done. I mean, you know, we were, you know, turf war, you know, obviously you score points in your backfield, which is fine. Carl, you know, to be honest, Carl probably had the momentum of the game. And was heading for a win. And again, you know, there were issues around time because things weren't getting killed. And obviously Carl was brick summoning stuff in and what have you. You know, we both had high model counts and I think we only got as far as turn 3. And it was one of those, in fact, actually we were only partway through turn 3. Last activation got called. Carl finished what he was doing, and I activated Shenlong. And at that point, Carl was ahead, very much so. And I just looked at the board, and it was like, right, okay, Shen. And I was able to sort of use those 3 AP along with the kind of free action that can trigger an interact, so you really got 4 AP if you're trying to score, and I managed to push him off a turf war marker and flip the turf war marker to draw the game, and it was literally just that activation flipped it. It was just one of those games, you know, I don't think either of us particularly enjoyed it in the sense that there was just so much frustration and we just couldn't get purchase into, you know, our respective plans.
It's so tough, Paul, because, you know, 3 rounds of Malifaux is a lot different than 5 rounds, and playing for 3 rounds, which is what you know, don't know necessarily going into it, is tough. And sounds like you had a bit of a frustrating slap fest that happened there. But boy, oh boy, if you only have 1 activation left, there's few models better to have it with than Shenlong, just because he can score some points in just 1 activation. So the other matchup we have is we have James and Jamie battling it out in round 5. So James, let's start with you. What was the matchups and how did the game look from your side of the table?
Yeah, so turf war into Jamie's an interesting game, and I wasn't totally sure which way he'd go, but I was worried about Von Stuck, so I decided to go Sandeep because he's less vulnerable to being stunned rather than Karis, because I could play either of those into that objective. So went that way. Unfortunately, guessed right. That Jamie was going to play Von Stuck, and then it was into kind of crew selection, and that again was probably where some key decisions were made. I decided to stay off fire because Von Stuck kills fire golems like nobody's business. That's something I've learned to my cost in previous games, but not wrong-footed this time. And So between that, and so went for ice with Sandeep, which gave me a bit of things there. And then I had to sort of choose between starting with the Golem, which probably in hindsight would have been the right move, and putting magical training on Sandeep, which gives him a bit more protection against Assassinate. Yep. And I don't know if Jamie was planning Assassinate from the pool. That's something probably he can help with, but I sort of decided to try and protect Sandeep off Assassinate rather than run that risk, given I know Jamie likes an aggressive playstyle.
I'll always consider Assassinate. I probably just the shielded he gives himself would probably been enough to turn me away from Assassinate on him.
What did you end up picking scheme wise then, Jamie?
Breakthrough and Power Ritual, because
okay.
schemes with By Your Side is always good.
Filth.
Did him picking Sandeep factor into your crew build at all?
Not really. I was expecting Karis, just because I know James is very well practiced with Karis and it's a good Karis strat. But I can understand if the whole fire golem issue with Von Stuck. But yeah, so I wasn't expecting the ice. If I'd got a read on the ice elementals, I would have taken a student of steel, but I assumed he would stick with fire for some reason.
All right, good. So Jamie, from your side of the table, how does the game play out? So first of all, how many rounds did you guys finish?
We got through three.
Three.
Got through three. It ends up being a tie. Jamie, is there anything you think you could have done over those three turns that would have changed that to a win?
There was a couple of key bits. So the game actually swung massively. So turn one, it swung. So it was a bit fluky in my favor. I sent Valedictorian in and killed a Soulstone Miner, which for the investment was probably fair. But then I got very lucky killing a Ice Gammon with Anna at range, which I think it was down to like a double severe on a neg flip for damage, which took it off, which stopped James getting a golem turn one.
That's
which was
big.
A big swing.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of turn two, it swung back around where Valedictorian went down very cheaply to just endless moderates on negs, coming mm-hmm. back to bite me in the ass after killing the Ice Gammon. The game swung like over turn one and two back and forth a bit. And then, I'm not actually sure where it would have gone if we'd carried on, but it felt pretty even as we were continuing. And I'd have felt pretty comfortable carrying on into it. But yeah, it was a pretty action packed first three turns.
Yeah, it sounds like it, James. And I haven't played against Sandeep yet. Any kind of tips or thoughts on, what you're facing there and what to watch out for?
There's a number of things. I think probably one of the things that's often sort of underpriced is underconsidered is his ability to tell his stuff to do things. Mm-hmm. And that obey is often as potent as the summon and the toss on Banner Suva. I'm rapidly coming around to the belief that toss is probably one of the best and most undervalued abilities in the game. And I think there was a moment, I think I surprised Jamie by tossing the Spider Swarm 10 inches across the board at Valedictorian, which he was not expecting, I don't think, as it just sort of slides across casually to go. And that was what ended up deleting Valedictorian on turn two.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That's good.
I've seen toss from another Arcanist model, Kojo. It's an excellent ability, but it ties into things that we've talked about on the show a million times is positioning and movement efficiency is a really big deal in three just because of the structure of the way the strats and the schemes work. Jamie, any other key points or takeaways from your game with James?
I think only how it ended, which was James managed to deny me breakthrough turn two and had and then I'd sort of set myself up to get it turn three and thought I'd more or less got it. And then on the last activation of turn three, James warped something along to get himself what was it you took? Hold Up the Forces and deny me breakthrough, and I looked at the board going, I thought, oh, I've probably got it here. I think I've won it. And then that swung it, denied me a point, and got him a point. I was like, oh, no. And like we'd looked at it and gone, well, James has won by a point. And then James was just looking at the board and he goes, gets his measuring stick out. And actually, where Von Stuck places scheme markers as he's killing things, and actually I'd placed another scheme marker. I'd managed to sort of inadvertently and flukily put three scheme markers down in his deployment zone to score the end of game point of breakthrough to bring it back to a draw.
Well, what a gentlemanly thing for James to point out.
Wow. I'm not going to lie. I considered staying quiet for possibly longer than is gentlemanly, but no, it was only fair.
You're not saying you're not capable of it, James. You just didn't do it, right?
I'd like to think I'm better than that. At least
that's funny.
Most days of the week, but certainly it was one of those.
It's a shout out to something that Jamie, you talked about on the deep dive, is that that inadvertent ski marker dropping that you get from Von Stuck comes into a play a lot more than when you think about it and just look at the cards.
Yeah, super solid, super solid.
It's interesting to have the situation you guys were in. So, I mean, at this point, you know, you've played Jamie. Jamie's played James. We've got some ties going into that. So how things matched up into the round six and then really how things ended up filling out are interesting. So when we get back from this break, let's talk about the final round. Howdy folks, Craig here. Now if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. All right, so last round. Now all the battles between the three of you are finished. So now it's just a matter of how strong you can, you know, finish things off here. That's going to determine who's going to make podium. And we already know that you guys did. So let's talk about round six. It's a corner deployment with plan explosives. It's got breakthrough, dig their graves, outflank, assassinate, and claim jump. And with plant in corners, you have a lot of choices, right? So what are you going to do? Are you going to spread out? Are you going to focus on just one area of the opponent's field, which obviously is a lot easier to defend? But you got two schemes that focus on killing. You've got one that's pushing you into the middle, one pushing you to neutral corners, and one pushing you to the opponent's corner. So there's a lot of really interesting choices. I thought this was a very interesting pool. Paul, we're going to talk about you playing Bayou and that being a win against Reese. But first, I want to know, you know, what was your thoughts going into this pool?
I was comfortable. You know, the mobility game Shenlong loves because of the Wandering River monks and because the Wandering River style. I've got huge mobility, so you know, starting off in a corner mm-hmm. does not frighten me unless the board is very problematic. And the fact that my opponent is going to have to move. What I tend to be able to do is react in the sense that, you know, if I see one side or the other being where I want to be to sort of try and create an asymmetric sort of game on one side of the board.
Yeah, kind of that denied flank concept, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, in flank deployment, it tends to be a bit obvious because people are already kind of where they are. Yeah. And you can't actually take advantage of that so easily. But in corner, you know, people tend to end up committing. And the minute they do, particularly if they split their forces, I can decide to dominate one flank, which, you know, is how I tend to play it.
Well, and that's just, I would imagine, Paul, that's just a matter of deciding which side Shenlong goes on, right? So you could kind of, you know, split your forces relatively easily, and then wherever Shenlong ends up and he can get wherever he needs to be, I think would cause that imbalance.
Yeah, and particularly with you know Yasunori is so quick as well.
Yeah.
You can really kind of just complete, even if a player has gone heavy into one side, as long as they've split the forces some degree, being able to dominate that, it makes it easier to right. dominate, is the long and the short of it. So, from the point of view of the deployment and the schemes, Planet Explosive I love, Outflank is again a sort of a good game for me. I was comfortable.
Good. And what keyword or master did a respring?
Well, I was comfortable about the schemes and strats. I was a little worried about the fact I was going to Bayou. I haven't played them much. I've been surprised just how effective some of the keywords are, and there's some I just haven't a clue about. So Reese, I was incredibly relieved when he declared zip. Which, it made a lot of sense in terms of, the board and the game. But Zip is the one master that I have played a little bit of, not just in Bayou, but also in Outcast. So, right. As soon as he did that, that helped me a lot in terms of, understanding what I was facing. And the thing with Zip is obviously he's got that incredibly powerful defense trigger, which I can just shut down with Masked Agent. Yeah. So, it was one of those where the game was largely decided in the in the declaration of masters and mm-hmm. team choice. So I sort of took my normal crew, but I put Masked Agent onto Shenlong, and critically I also put Masked Agent onto Yasunori.
That's nice.
Nice isn't perhaps the right word. So we got into it. He split his forces with Zip and about half his models went one way, half his model went the other. So I went heavy to my left. Got into he had an Iron Skeeter, Bert Jedson, and who am I? What was the other sort of? There was definitely Bert there. He didn't last very long. Oh yeah,
I'm sure first mate.
Say again. The first mate was on the other side of the board, and I was real pleased about that. Along with Keris, the rocket. The one with the rocket strapped to her back.
I can't think of with an M. Maris. I know who you're talking about.
Maris rather than Kerry. So Maris and Zip and the first mate went to his left, my right, and then the rest of his crew went over to, on his right side, my left. So I went heavy into mm-hmm. the left and just destroyed him. He had McTavish, that was his other model, on that side of the board, and I just went straight in, smashed McTavish, killed Bert. The Iron Skeeter was in the far corner but was isolated, and the game sort of turned. This would have been sort of round two. He dropped two of his bombs over on this side. I think I see a lot of players in games like with Planet Explosives and Idols that are very fast. And what they tend to do is sort of get over and do too much in round one and round two. mm-hmm. and the sort of trying to get ahead in terms of the tempo. But what I'll tend to do is let them do that shit and then just go into them with my crew, at which point, and this is exactly what happened. He dropped two bombs down. I'm going to say turn two. And so I just killed all his models and then had the ability to grab those bombs.
Clean them up after that, yeah?
Yeah. So in reacting to that, and I had taken Assassinate against Zip. So he decided he needed to sort of try and do something over on that, you know, try and interfere on some level with what was going on over there. So he shot Zip over, which was a huge mistake because he was then in range of Yasunori. And I think he'd forgotten. Yeah. Obviously, he knew the upgrade was on, but I think he was too, so focused on Shenlong and Shenlong having that upgrade that he forgot about Yasunori. So Yasunori came in, did some serious damage on him. And then my students came in and beat the crap out of him as well. And because it's, and because it's an aura, poor old Zip actually got killed with a broom attack.
Wow. I mean, you disable that defensive tech on Zip and he is not that hard to bring down at that point. And you know, the speed that you get with Yasunori and Shenlong and having that tech pick really to bring that through, and you being able to just wipe sides of the board is great. I think it's real interesting what you're saying though, Paul, because we hear a lot on the podcast about, you want to seed your points early, and get them out there so that you can, you know, react and play defense. But I think your perspective is an interesting one, which is, you know, once you've seeded all those points out there, you've tipped your hand a little bit. And then, you know, you're giving more information in the process. So I think it's interesting. Those two different, perspectives. James, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that'll come up again in my game. Is that sort of actually getting, because bombs are safer generally when they're in someone's hands, right. And getting them down too early, particularly where they're on, you know, it's very difficult in a proper game of explosives where both of you have fast crews, and particularly where you're much quick, you know, you're both very agile, very quick. Once a bomb's on the table, it's fairly vulnerable. And so not dropping them when you don't need them down is probably is a waste. So I'd really echo Paul's point there. And I think for me, it probably you get away with it where you're playing at a lower level and one of you can really build a very fast crew and the other can't. Mm-hmm. And then you can use space much more effectively to, you know, to protect your bombs. I don't think you can expect to do that on the top tables at the end of an event. And I think that's something probably to watch out for.
No, that's interesting. Well, James, let's roll right into your matchup. So you got a chance to play Carl in Rezzers. You won 6-2. You know, again, I thought this pool was really interesting. So I first like to know, you know, what did you bring and what did Carl bring as far as keywords?
So I brought Sandeep and Carl brought Molly. I played against Carl a couple of times. He's a great TO. I know you've had him on the show. You know, runs a lot of local events. So, you know, really great to play against Carl. We were playing on a streamed, one of the stream, you know, the stream table at the event, which was interesting. And I get a little bit paranoid with that sort of thing because we were talking about, you know, I think as we had a brief chat offline about making mistakes. And I think, it's one of these things, Malifaux is such a complex game. I don't think anyone plays a game of Malifaux where they don't make at least one rules error somewhere or do some positioning thing or whatever. And it's quite difficult when you're then it's being recorded and watched back. And I know other games have had problems in the past where people have made mistakes on sort of on streamed games and then had a, you know, then had to deal with a witch hunt after the event. So I was probably a little bit slow through this game, partly explaining what I was doing to the audience and partly trying to remember not to swear and partly trying to make sure I wasn't going to then be in trouble for having made a terrible error at some point.
Or not yell free Hong Kong.
Revolution in our time.
That's right.
The sort of, I think at that point you're supposed to go hide under a desk though, Craig, and then get fired anyway. I'm not sure if I should give my views on that whole situation, but
that's a whole separate podcast, my friend.
That's a whole other podcast. But fortunately, no one here is relying on the Chinese government for an income, so we can say what we think. So I think me and Carl have this weird habit when we play. For some reason, we wound up, last few times we've played, we wound up playing in corner deployment where one of the corners is a pig to get out of. And I'm probably only remembering that because it seems to be me that gets stuck in that corner. So that added a bit of challenge. But fortunately, Banasuva's task that I know we've talked about earlier, combined with sort of some speed that I hired in out of Keyword for Sandeep, really let me get out of the terrain quickly and get across the board. And to what Paul was saying, Carl found this, I think Carl had a few things where he'd taken quite an elite crew. He'd taken a rogue necromancy archie and the dead rider.
Oh, wow.
Who had bombs. A really quite elite crew. And the tension was like Archie had, the way the game played out, Archie wound up having to drop a bomb on turn two to get the, you know, to get his point in that turn, which kind of created this weird thing because I could leave Kandara nearby. And it's like, right, the moment you move, I'm getting that bomb. And that caused him, that sort of started to cause him real challenges to what Paul was saying. One of the things I like about Sandeep in Explosives is Wind Gamin have that wonderful demise ability that when they're killed, they get to place a friendly model within 8 inches of them, within 4 inches of themselves. So it's what you can do quite nicely in a Sandeep crew is have a Wind Gamin guard something like a bomb. Your opponent kills the Wind Gamin, as Carl did in our game, and then something else just go, right, well, I'm going to go stand on that bomb now. Now what are you going to do? And it creates that. It can make it quite difficult. That combined with the Sandeep's ability to push a friendly elemental and 2 inches and make them take an action means that there's a lot of ability to move, you know, to sort of reposition on the fly in the crew.
Right.
And sort of get models where you need to be if you need to cover bombs, which makes it a bit easier. And that combined with sort of really aggressively going at my schemes managed to let me get ahead 6-2. But it was an interesting game. I think the stream is still out there. So if you want to see me, want to comb through that and look for the mistake I inevitably made in the rules somewhere, you're very welcome. And please write in and tell me.
Yeah, we've got a couple streams up on our YouTube channel, James, and I know what you're saying, but you got to, you know, and I've had people play on our streams that are nervous about it. And I know it's easier said than done, but you just got to play. And
absolutely.
But yeah, you're right. I don't know if there's ever been a perfectly played Malifaux game yet where every rule was done exactly right because of the intricacies. Luckily, I think 3 has less points of failure, potential failure than 2. But
not in 2 hours, not under time conditions at the end of a weekend of 6 rounds of Malifaux, and potentially drinking and bad food. And, you know, we haven't talked about the fact that Jamie and his team makes Rune Weatherspoons, you know, drinking when we arrived at the venue on Sunday morning, you sort of at the end, you know, across one of these weekends, you're not going to play perfectly in every game. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to catch the majority of them both ways around, but there are going to be things that get done wrong. And you've got to live with that, but it's just a bit more nerve wracking. You go, we recorded for posterity. And especially when, so there's an interesting thing because I moderate the weird forums, occasionally you'll sort of, when you have to do something, you get some people then get into a weird thing of trying to find something you've done wrong somewhere else that makes the thing they did wrong less.
Right.
It can be a bit awkward.
Yeah, they should go into politics at that point because that's all we do in politics. But
exactly.
Hey, Jamie, so you ended up winning the event and your final round was against AJ Bars Bayou. It was a nice 6-4 win. And you and James ended up finishing with the same win-loss record, but it was your 3-point differential. So you beating AJ by 2 after, you know, with James winning his by 4 was a big deal. First off, what did AJ bring and what did you bring?
So I took Molly, a fairly standard Molly crew for myself. So Molly with Archie and the Rogue Necromancy and then all the scheme runners in the world. And AJ bought Mar Tucket with the whole focus rooster shooting shenanigans that is her current tournament list.
Yeah.
It's a really, really good game. AJ's actually a teammate, so he's one of the flipping weirds. So it was good to play him. He played it really, really well. There was I was a little bit ragey, and it's fair to say, on turn two when because it was clear that AJ had outflank and I had outflank as well.
Yeah.
And there was a Bayou Bushwhacker on one flank corner and a Rooster Rider on the other flank corner. So the Bayou Bushwhacker I put Archie into and didn't kill it, and then put two by your side in Krooligans into it and still didn't kill it to deny out flank. And I was like, right, okay, right, whatever, other flank. So in the other flank, the Rogue Necromancy and a Night Terror went into this Rooster Rider and didn't kill it. And I was just like, I just looked at the board and I was like, AJ, I don't understand how this has happened. One of those models should be dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of pain into those models. I mean, those Bushwhackers are so damn good, though.
It's so it stopped me picking up a bomb and denying him outflank. So it was a massive swing in the game. And I was looking at it going, oh my, like, I was really quiet. And what it had also done is, because I'd had to use so many models to try and do it, it set me back on my breakthrough, which was my other scheme.
Yep.
But luckily, because those models were in the right places, they managed to kill them both turn three and then sort of defend them to stop him getting the second point. And he had chosen Claim Jump for his other scheme on Trixie, which he got because I wasn't expecting Claim Jump. It's just not one I expect people to take, to be honest. But he'd taken it on Trixie, so I managed to get her below half wounds to deny the second point on that and just get consistent points from the bombs because Molly's crew is super mobile.
It's a good strat. A good strat for her.
It was a really good game. I with the shenanigans with these models not dying, which in hindsight was due to Bryn stacking the deck into some monster of just severe cards. But yeah, it was a really good game. Really enjoyable.
That's great. Well, congratulations, Jamie. That's a good win. And like I said, you know, the fact that it was only differential that made the difference is kind of harkens back to kind of what we talked about whether, you know, trying to quote unquote play down to get better matchups early rounds. I think that's proof positive that that's probably not a good play. So I've got three people to play this game that I really respect. And so I want to kind of talk about the top 10 at the end of that and get your thoughts. So here's how the top 10 shook out as far as factions are concerned. You had three Rezzers in the top 10, two 10 Thunders, two Bayou, one Arcanist, one Outcast, one Guild, and no Neverborn made the top 10. Huge, you know, small sample size. You know, this is not, you know, anything to worry about. But what I do want to kind of get a feel for, James, let's start with you. You know, can you kind of give me a feel of where you think the factions are right now? And of course, that's going to change 6 months from now. But I'd be interested to know what you think are some of the meatier factions and maybe some factions that you think might need a little bit of attention.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I actually think we're in a pretty good spot for all of the Reza bashing I've done, and the surprising lack of Arcanist bashing we've had on the show, which I'll thank you all for. I actually wrote down how many Soulstone Miners and Swarms I took during this event for when that inevitably came up, and I haven't got to use that.
I already know the answer, James. So
you know, but I would like to be prepared. I mean, I would take the view. I think actually, when you look at it, Arcanist, Reza, Outcasts and Thunders, I think all have, you know, an incredibly good game. I think the Bayou probably underrated at the moment. And so probably, you know, there as well. I think the only place where you've probably got concerns right now are a Guild. And I know a lot of their good stuff is not out. So there's potential there. Neverborn seem to be a little bit behind the curve, but again, I mean, this event was underrepresentative in the player base for Neverborn, so I think there's something in that. But right now, I mean, this is probably the most balanced I've ever seen Malifaux. I've been playing since early in first edition, and it's the most balanced I've ever seen it. And I think by this point in second edition, we'd had errata, and it was very clear that there were things that were way out of line. And actually, I don't see that as we go through the game right now. I think the game's probably the most balanced it's ever been, and you know, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think we're in a really balanced place for the game. I think rather than factions being, well, aside from 10 Thunders, obviously, rather than factions being an issue, I think you've got a few models here and there, which I think we can all say are a little bit ahead of the curve, but not not ruining anyone's hobby, apart from Ten Thunders, obviously. I'm joking. But I think, Guild, I think James is quite right. I think we've not seen a lot of them because, well, actually, I mean, also to be fair, like if we look back at our player base, and you've got sort of Lewis, who was one of the prolific Guild players, was running the big event up into those running events in Scotland now. So he's not really been playing in them. You've got Matt, who was the top Guild player for a long time here, is not playing them anymore. So I think we've just not got anyone sort of adopted them here yet, really. Neverborn, I think the Neverborn's problem is they've got two amazing masters, and the rest of them aren't really seeing as much, but they've definitely got some power there. There's a lot of play in a lot of their keywords. So I think, we're in a really balanced place. I think it will settle out, and it will come down to, as Malifaux always usually does, is player skill. It'll be what is seen as the, or perceived as the best, will be what the best players are using. And it's the, what makes the game great. I mean, and that's why you can have the UK and the US argue over what's broken and what's not broken, and disagree over what's good and what's not good. Because actually, the different players at different skill levels playing it will tell you a completely different story about it.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you firsthand, playing a strong, we have a really strong Guild player here, Jesse Watson, who's a henchman. And, you know, if someone thinks that Guild is in a bad place, you know, just needs to play against Jesse. And I think it'll change your mind. But I'm not disagreeing, though. So I think that the gap is very small. But if I have to, you know, put them in order, I don't disagree with what either you or James has said, as far as that's concerned.
Just before we get to Paul, I'll probably just quickly come back in on one point around models. I think there are definitely, you know, Jamie's right, there are definitely some models that are under-costed that will turn up a lot. And, you know, I think I see that in, you know, a number of factions right now. What I think will be interesting, and the thing I would probably keep an eye on, is how much out of keyword hiring tax people are paying.
Yep.
And I think if we start to see a position where people are routinely paying more than one soulstone, or certainly seeing more than one soulstone in every game, if the average ever creeps above, you know, above 1.5, maybe, hiring tax, I think that would be a good warning sign. I think as it is right now, the stuff that's overrepresented is broadly versatile, or is broadly kind of inside its keyword. And I think that probably speaks to the design doing what it should be doing.
Yeah, and I think the other thought I was having too, thinking about balancing across the actual factions, and this is actually something I think that's really interesting, is having generic upgrades. I mean, you can boost or potentially spank a faction just by addressing those three upgrades and either adding some, changing them, or anything, and that could potentially have a pretty big impact.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see them, you know, to address balance. I'd like to see us get back to that, potentially back to the errata cycle we had in second edition, or potentially what I'd really like to see them do is when we get around to Gen Con every year, actually pick two keywords in each faction and redo them entirely, and just pick if they're out of line away from the curve in either direction, right? Just go through the faction, and go, okay, well, this faction's got two really underpowered keywords, let's bring those up. This faction's got an underpowered Nova, let's bring those back into line. I think that's the kind of thing you can do now with the amount of print-on-demand stuff they've got, and potentially re-sculpt them at the same time to drive the sales. And I think I'd like to see that approach to balance, because there's no reason, I don't think, we couldn't get into a cycle of that over time, provided you weren't doing the same keyword every year. I don't personally see a problem with that. I'm sure people who are closer to the industry might do.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that would be the best way to do it. I think we don't want really many more models in terms of new. Obviously, we've got a whole new faction to come. But we don't want, I think we'll get into a dangerous territory if we start adding too much to the existing factions again. And I think, James, the idea to redesign existing keywords as the release rather than releasing new models is just a much better direction to go in. We need to keep the the ranges roughly the size they are now for each faction, because otherwise it's just too much and you end up with the power creep that you we ended up with in M2E.
Yeah, and I think honestly that you know where I'm starting to get on this one on that point, guys, is you know, we got to keep in mind Weird's got to sell models, right? So to stay open, they can't just put out new rules. That doesn't sell nearly as much as the new models. They do have a new faction to work with, so there's opportunity there. I am really, you know, after going through Dead Man Hands, I'm okay with part of that balancing being an annual rotation where they, you know, they Dead Man Hand, they put out five new models. And they Dead Man Hand five models, so that the size, Jamie, to your point, stays about the same. But they use that to A, sell models, and B, you know, to present some balance.
I'd do a keyword here, you know, from each faction potentially, and you can bring the player base into that in different ways. I think provided you clear it's Dead Man's Hand, you kind of you create an expectation that. Anything new that you print is, I mean, whatever you do, players will riot because internet, but you know, you could create an expectation. Okay. If we introduce a new keyword, that keyword is safe for 2 years.
X amount of time. Yeah.
So that no one buys a model that they know is going to be dead in or out of competitive play, a new model that's out of competitive play within 2 years. And then actually go, yeah, you can do some story stuff with that, because part of the attraction of Malifaux is the story moves on, and I'd be up for, you know, and some people could potentially break out of jail and return as our spidery mechanical overlord.
What are your thoughts, Paul? Where do you think things are shaking out as far as faction versus faction?
The game,
you kind of share the same thoughts as James and Jamie? Or?
Space. I mean, there's just so many sort of exciting things and challenging things out there. You know, obviously everybody's focused on Shenlong, but you've got like Dreamer, obviously Von Stuck, you know, again, you know, the Arcanists have got depth and all sorts of interesting sort of things with lots of mechanical legs. You know, it's, you know, where and the Bayou is, well, Jamie's going to the Bayou, so that's all you really need to know, you know.
That answers every question you might have had.
I'm surprised you're not already on him on that bandwagon with him, Paul. Like, I'm amazed you've restrained yourself for this length of time.
I'm sorry, but Goblins in Denim is just I have limits, and that's on the wrong side of that limit, you know. So
Paul has standards. You heard it here first.
I'm not sure where this reputation that because I'm playing it, it must be broken.
Yeah.
I think you've got it. But then I don't know why Paul has the slow player tag anymore. I don't think he is that slow. I don't think he is that slow anymore. I think, you know.
But going back to what I would say is, I mean, Neverborn, you know, I'm very excited about. I mean, I'd be in Neverborn now if Nakima had her totem available earlier in the competitive year. You know, I threw my toys out of the pram when I wasn't able to use her for one of the big sort of tournaments.
I remember you throwing your toys out the pram on that, because I was on a platform at King's Cross Station looking like a right madman trying to talk you down on that one.
I was proper pissed about that. But anyway, we'll move on. You know, thanks to that, the world got to have me on Shenlong. So, you know.
While we're complaining about Neverborn, there's something actually I'll bring in, and apologies for sort of crashing into your vocals there, Paul. You know, there's one thing I'll bring in on Neverborn actually, which is I think what I find amusing is about going back to the lack of Neverborn players at this event is I remember when Neverborn were one of the best factions, if not, you know, utterly broken for the majority of second edition and the majority of first edition. People always tell me, oh, it's because they're really fluffy and, you know, they're really nice. And I really like the look and the feel of Neverborn, the background of Neverborn. That's why I'm playing them. Where are they now?
Yeah, I tell you know, and I think, and we kind of brought it up too. So, you know, Guild is suffering because there's some keywords that are missing key models. I've had a chance to play against Euripides three times now. And I don't know if Euripides is going to be good competitively, but he is really fun to play against. And I think there's some power to unlock there, but we're not going to really see it until, you know, that box becomes more prolific. And, you know, the bottom line is we only have a handful of Neverborn players here in the Carolinas. It's, you know, it's mostly dominated by, you know, Rezzers, Arcanists, Outcasts, and Ten Thunders. You know, we have very few guild players as well. So, and, you know, I think that Bayou has snuck under. I have played now against a couple good Bayou players, and there is a ton of power in that faction. So it'll be interesting to see how it play out. So we found out Paul has got kind of a left eye on Neverborn. We found, you know, Jamie's starting to dabble with Bayou. James, is there at any point, are you going to get off the Arcanist train and at least try something else?
I certainly will at some point. And, you know, people forget, you know, I'm predominantly an Arcanist, but I've at various points in my Malifaux history, you know, I've had the best Neverborn badge, the best Outcast, the best Thunders badge, I think, but certainly the best Guild badge. And, you know, I've played around with a lot of factions in the past. So, you know, I will definitely move again at some point. I've often been sort of, if you think Arcanists and Outcasts are the opposite side of the same coin, whereas Arcanists are sort of the investigators in a Lovecraft story. The Outcasts are probably the ones that succumb to the dark power. And I kind of see myself going over there for a bit at some stage, but I don't have the painting time. I don't like playing with unpainted stuff, and I don't have the painting time in my life right now. So I am leveraging the fact that I have a lot of painted Arcanists as much as anything else.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Well, gentlemen, congratulations. Like I said, strong finish, and good luck to all three of you at the Nationals coming up. I would love to see some more Third Floor Wars guests proving that just by being on the show, you're a better player. I'm sure we'll be catching up, and I bet hopefully I'll be inviting you guys back for the Nationals podium because you make it. James, any plugs or anything before we go?
Just my usual plug for my FLGS, who do me, you know, brilliant service every time, and are great on Malifaux stuff in the UK and internationally. And that's Leodis Games in Leeds. So big plug to them. They're fantastic.
They're great. Paul, do you have any plugs?
Sorry, I'm currently gluing models onto bases ready for tomorrow. Because, you know, filth.
That's all right. So what glue are you using, Paul?
Super glue. So, you know.
All right. So Paul's plug is to be using super glue to put it to your bases. Jamie, do you have any plugs?
No, nothing I can think of. Just the usual sort of, if you're listening to this, you're probably already in Malifaux chat groups on Messenger and stuff like that. But if you are not, then get involved.
Yeah, Jamie and I are both in the Rezzer chat, and it's been great. And I know James, I think you get the impression you're enjoying the Arcanist chat.
I do blunder in there every now and again and go off at people asking stupid rules questions, or more to point, asking rules questions wrong. Yeah, answering rules questions wrong.
I wonder, James, if that's the same person that I do that to in the Rezzer group.
What amazes me is like if someone asks a question, like four people answer it wrong, and then before anybody even looks at any of the rules involved in the question, that's it. So my amaze is could someone have at least like pretended to look at the rules before we answered this question?
We didn't ask for your hot take. We wanted the answer. Yeah.
It's just like somebody read the rules, please.
That's really funny.
But no, not anything on tournament policy where I have very firm views.
That's funny. There you go. All right, guys. Well, we'll be talking to you soon. I'm trying to work out some time, James, to get you up for the Sandeep deep dive. So we'll talk about that offline.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, man. For everybody listening, I appreciate you listening. So take care. Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the US Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service.
Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.
For everybody listening, I appreciate you listening, so take care.
Just before he disappears.
Great fucking timing, Paul.
Wandering River style. What are people's thoughts on this thing with the you're dropping the markers that you know and turning them into friendly?
I think we should just leave this in the end of the episode. Do the outro as normal. Do your outro and just leave that on the end.
Oh, God.
Sorry, Paul. Yeah. There was a legitimate question there.
It is a legitimate question, and I'm going to stop the recording and let you guys answer it because I got to get going. But I appreciate it, guys. But you're welcome to stay on. But in fact, make sure you don't know this yet, Paul, but leave your browser open until you get the message that everything's downloaded.
Cool.
But I got to scoot, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you, lad.
Pleasure. Cheers, Greg.